Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark. I'm back with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Okay, so here's the deal. Today is March 9th. And I'm officially 21 days, 22 hours, 24 minutes, and 53 seconds away from going to Mount Everest. But this podcast is being played into the future now on April 23rd. So even though we're going back into the future, it's going to be played when I'm actually on Everest. And you can find out and follow the journey while I'm up there at www.markpattisonnfl.com. If you go and hit the little tab, follow the journey, you can see me on a Garmin app and watch me as my steps go up and down and up and down the mountain, which is pretty cool on this Garmin InReach mini tool that I have. So I'm like a walking satellite. It's awesome. And as always, I will continue to promote Amelia's Everest, the Lhotse Challenge, which is my philanthropy. I partner with Higher Ground, great organization. And we have been raising well over now $50,000 in part with the Las Vegas Raiders and the NFL both threw in. But other people like you who are listening to this podcast continue to contribute to this wonderful cause, helping military veterans and people like my daughter, Amelia, of overcoming cognitive issues like epilepsy, which she's had for the last, she's 8 and now she's 22, so you guys can do the math, but for a long time. So we're trying to get there, okay? So speaking of the military, I have got a just inspirational, amazing guy on today, Oscar Oz Sanchez. Oz, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Mark. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, I want to give a quick shout out to Brian Von Hubelis. He's another military war hero that's now working with Higher Ground. You know, when I had done a podcast with him not too long ago, and I said, Von, man, if there's somebody else that you think would be inspirational for the theme of this podcast, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way, you know, let me know. And he said, you know what, I've got the guy. I mean, if you talk about adversity, and you've got this you know, tagline called no limits. And I think you had to come up with that because, you know, when you're growing up, it sounded like you did have a lot of limits and you were like that typical kid that could have gone every which way but loose in terms of ending up in jail and leading a life not fulfilled. And you've done just the opposite, even though there's been more adversity in your way. So let's start off with your childhood and the kind of tough environment that you grew up. It didn't sound like Leave It to Beaver, white picket fence. We're talking about downtown LA, somewhere East LA, and some pretty tough stuff going on.
Yeah. It's always really difficult to kind of reflect back on how bad things were. And they were mostly the situation at home, because I have a great relationship with both my parents. And, I just hate to, you know, especially in this cancel culture that we have right now, that, you know, we vilify and when somebody commits something bad, you know, they're evil and usually they're, you know, irrevocably evil. But our situation was, you know, my parents were first generation immigrants into the States, and, you know, despite having no education, no prior experience, they wanted to raise their family in the typical American dream. So nevertheless, you know, they did the best they could, but there was a lot of stumbles and falls and whatnot. My dad worked, pretty much 7 days a week, 12 hours a day for a large part of his career while we were growing up. And mother was a stay-at-home mother. Mother had a lot of childhood trauma. She was, severely depressed. I recall she attempted suicide once, and I walked in on her while she was bleeding out in the bathtub. I'm somewhere between 8 to 11 years of age. Much of my childhood, because of this trauma and my mechanisms to survive in this environment, was my blocking out memories altogether. So much of my childhood experience is almost a blank slate, unfortunately. But you know, we did the best that we could. So my thing really started to become, I had a twin sister, have a twin sister and an older brother. My older brother seemed to always have a plan. He executed on that plan. You know, was going to get his good grades, going to, you know, college with an alternate path of joining the military. And he did that to the T. I remember him sharing with this with me somewhere, you know, I think when he was 15, he's 2 years my senior. So I was, you know, 12, 13. And then myself and my twin sister just kind of go with the flow, product of our environment, you know, very much, you know, one direction to the next was, you know, more so to do with who we were hanging out with and all those types of influences. So we got into using meth when we were about 13, 14 years of age. You know, we didn't have a sense of belonging at home or a community or a family, if you will. So, you know, the brain says, I have to find that somewhere. So some of us joined bands, some of us joined sports. You know, at that age, we joined, you know, the sort of gang mentality and we gravitated towards that. I would say what kept me probably from going too far off the deep edge was that my sort of self-therapeutic mechanism was sports. And I leaned into sports and I got into mountain biking really early. I think at 13 years of age, I was already going out at 2-3 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the night with my bike under the moonlight, just riding the hillsides and did pretty good with that. But once I got out of high school, like I had no option, you know, no access to sports, you know, competitively or organized sports anyways in high school. So that's when things kind of took a turn for the worst.
So I want to go back and I'm not sure if I heard you right, but you're 13 and 14 years old and I wasn't sure if there was a drug that you were turning to at that point, if I heard you right.
Yeah. Methamphetamine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine. So what is that? Is it you hallucinate? Is that what it makes you do?
It's an amphetamine. So it jacks you up. It's, you know, kind of like cracked out. You ever familiar with the Dave Chappelle show, you know, how you lift buses and all that.
Yeah.
So it just gets you really high. It's kind of like an adrenaline rush. It's what we call the poor man's version of cocaine.
Yeah. And is this the gateway, how the gang guys get you sucked up into that life? Is that part of the path?
That's an interesting question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before, but I would say it probably has something to do with it. I know that much of the dealers, what they do is they, you know, give it out for free in the neighborhood for a while, get people kind of, you know, sort of dependent on it. And then after a while is when they start marking up the prices. How gangs, you know, generate revenue is very much in, you know, pushing and dope dealing. And so I remember I was sort of tag along with the tax man on a couple of outings. And so without my really knowing what was going on, yeah, that was probably very much what was going on, unfortunately.
Yeah. So now you're in this drug gang street life existence and you're through high school, and because you're not in organized sports and all these other things, you know, you're just wondering, and that kind of becomes your family. Things aren't great at home. Where does the switch go off in terms of having that self-recognition of, I'm not going anywhere, this isn't going where, and I need to take a hard pivot and a right-hand turn to fix this? And then your mind starts to go towards, I want to join the Marines.
Well, I'll answer the last part and then digress back to the beginning. So we grew up in an area where we had an alleyway, and me and my brother were skateboard with our, you know, amigos in that alleyway. And around the corner was both the county courthouse and all four branches of military recruiting. So we were very much sort of imprinted and attracted to the posters and the billboards that were around this recruiting station all the time. And I can remember as far back as like being, wow, like 6 years old, just always being impressed and impressed upon by these billboards, especially for me anyways, the Marine Corps emblem of the few, the proud, the Marines was always kind of my thing. I don't know why. You know, much like Von Herbulis said, it's just like that grit and that pit bull and that like rabid dog, because that's kind of how we grew up with mother's, conditioning. So I was always kind of taken to the Marine Corps, and my brother was always taken to the Army. And for as far back as I can think of, we always fantasize that like, oh, when I join, you know, I'm going to join the Army. And my version was I'd be in the Marine Corps. And I was just kind of just, you know, running my mouth. I never actually envisioned that I would be ever a caliber of an individual that could succeed or thrive in an environment like the Marine Corps. But we fantasize, right? And there, and it's safe to fantasize when we're that young because we're not being held accountable to these things. For whatever reason, my brother always seemed to actually have that realistic plan towards that, and he executed on that. So what I find, you know, going back to the beginning of the question, was that I was always kind of pivoting between where my sister was at and where my brother was at. And my sister was kind of like, I hate to say it, but considered the black sheep. I assume because of she was the only female in the immediate family. And then most of the pain that we were experiencing was coming from our mother's abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, and torment. And so I think she picked on my sister. So my sister was probably more broken down, and she got more into the drugs, more into the thugging, and dating a lot of the gangs, leadership, and never really kind of batted an eye when, you know, extreme violence or just something that was way off the wall, even drive-bys. Whereas I always kind of like, what are we doing? Like, this is, you know, this isn't what we were raised to do. This isn't, you know, even though shit sucks at home, like, you know, this, we've never been taught to inflict pain or hurt unnecessarily on anybody unless we're defending ourselves. And so my brother was the other opposite end of the extreme. And, was always good in school, did good in sports, excelled at both. And then when he joined the Army, I was, 17. And I actually graduated from high school at 17, not because I was smart or ahead of my class or anything like that, but I was literally kicked out of kindergarten because my sister and I didn't do well separated. So they just threw me into first grade and they kept my sister in kindergarten. So at 5 years old, I was in first grade instead of kindergarten. So I ended up graduating early. And so when I got out of high school, really, I started reflecting that the path that I was on wasn't going to do me any justice for, like, as far as what I would like for myself in my life. But there was this big, you know, the subconscious and the personal identity is I didn't actually believe I was fit to execute on any kind of plan, whether it be a career, college, military, you know, and my, you know, bleak ambitions for, an ideal life, even though I didn't desire it. Was, you know, I'd get a job or two and, hook up with some, you know, chavalita from, you know, I met at the club, have some kids, and, you know, that's probably about it, which is what, unfortunately, most of my peers did. But I did see that it was going to be hard to leave sort of that influence and the circle of network of friends and the homeboys that I was hanging out with just by saying, I'm joining the military later. So I ended up getting in the situation where we got picked up for looting, and I lied to the judge saying that I had plans to join the service, and if I did any kind of time for looting, then I'd be ineligible, and that, you know, he doesn't want to be responsible for ruining my life, and yada yada yada. And I wasn't, you know, in any way disarticulated about it, but he bit off on it. He obviously probably had a better idea what was going on than I did. He said, "Come back here with some documentation and a recruiter, and possibly, and you know, we'll take it from there." And so I went across the street, spoke to the recruiter, told him my situation. It's a big sham. I want you to help me out. I don't actually join. And the whole thing backfired in my face. And that's how I ended up in the Marine Corps.
Wow. Well, it's great.
I signed a federal document.
Yeah. Well, listen, it was a blessing in disguise, right? I want to ask a quick side question and then let's jump ahead. Your sister, you know, you talked about earlier, she chose the wrong path and was around the wrong people. Where is she today?
She's homeless addict. Yeah. She's been on the streets since I brought her down here to San Diego to help her out in 2012. So she's been homeless since then.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you something, and I used to tell my kids, this is that there's not a success story from anybody in the history of doing drugs where doing those things in the end run turned out to be a great outcome. Never one.
Right.
Time. Right. So, okay. Right. So let's move on from there. So, okay. So now you get in, and this seems like this was the kind of the kick in the ass, the having the discipline, the structure, a lot of the things that I went through with my football. I mean, it was different, of course, but the things that really put me on a focus of life, sounds like it had the same similar ripple effect on you as well. So talk about what that meant in terms of your experience. And then, you know, your story is so much grander to this. This is part of your story. I want to talk about it. but there's so much more down the road that I want to talk about and I want to get into, but let's jump into your marine life.
Yeah. So in the boot camp, I didn't really suffer a whole lot because one, I was pretty fit. You know, I had sort of gravitated towards physical fitness. So at about, I think 6-7 years of age, I remember I would do 100 ab crunches and sit-ups and push-ups before going to sleep, damn near every single night. Why I was doing this, I don't know, because nobody in my family, you know, prior to my brother and I, or in my generation, I should say as well, really worked out. So where that influence came from, I have no idea. But I did have this thing to sort of self-soothe because I was a really angry kid because of the, you know, what we had going on at home, specifically with our mother's situation. And so then I, as I said, I also started mountain biking at a young age, around 13. So by the time I got to Marine Corps boot camp at 17 years of age, the fitness component and pushing myself and pushing myself into, you know, a great deal of pain and being okay and comfortable with that pain wasn't anything new. The drill instructors screaming and getting in my face also wasn't anything new because my mother had done that, you know, and there was actual physical threat, you know, that could be carried out by my mother, whereas drill instructors, you know, couldn't really touch us for the most part. So really my biggest sort of, you know, Achilles tendon in boot camp was just respecting the hierarchy and the rank and authority, because I had sort of this sort of chip on my shoulder still. And the mindset, you know, was if I didn't feel you could, you know, kick my ass, then why do I have to listen to you, right? And in the Marine Corps, that simply wasn't going to fly. But because we don't have a whole lot of leadership roles in boot camp, it didn't seem to cause too big of a problem. But it did get addressed a couple of times by our platoon senior drill instructor. And it wasn't until I was actually in the Fleet Marine Corps and infantry commands that it, you know, it started to rear itself really fast. And so, you know, shy of a few beat downs, because the Marine Corps has always got a mechanism to wipe that old chip off your shoulder. I accepted and embraced the Marine Corps, you know, rank structure. And I said, you know, if I'm going to thrive in this environment, I got to learn to play the games by their rules. You know, I'm not just going to bring my own rules into an entire outfit like the Marine Corps. So I gave it a chance. And with that, I started making, you know, sort of records for promotions into, you know, corporal, lance corporal, matter of fact, sergeant, and deployed a couple of times while I was active duty. But the Marine Corps was very much an environment that I fell in love with right away. My brother was already a couple of years in his Army career by this point, and both of us, within a few years of being in service, said, this is a career. You know, there's nothing going back to LA for. And so, at least for myself, you know, Marine Corps, and then I got a chance to try out for Marine Corps Special Operations, and because there was a presentation that they gave to a recruiting presentation to our infantry command, and I asked my platoon leader if I can try out. I tried out, I made the initial screening, and then I got a chance to come over to Reconnaissance Command, and then I spent the next 5 years there before actually separating and having my injury.
Yeah. So, we're going to get into that now. So, you know, kind of the sum up in the 3 minutes of your overview, 14 years later, roughly, you know, you'd have this amazing career. You experienced a lot of different things. You're in multiple countries. I mean, I can't even imagine scout sniper, parachuting, you're doing all these really, really cool things. And then there's this awakening of like, you know, you've done that, you've challenged yourself, you're kind of the peak of your game. And now you want to transition over to become a Navy SEAL. I don't even know how you do that from, you know, elite Marine guy to Navy SEAL, but this is something you're going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, basically one of the issues that I had was, you know, I'd gotten promoted, you know, I was an assistant team leader on my first deployment. And then on my second deployment, I was a team leader. And I accomplished this all in the span of essentially 4 years in the Marine Corps. And so I felt that I had the ability to you know, just keep dreaming, keep looking bigger. What's the next peak? My brother had actually made selection into Army Special Forces himself. And so one of the issues that I had sort of discovered was at the time, the reconnaissance commands only played for specifically within the Marine Corps, because they were an outfit of and for the Marine Corps. And so we didn't have access to SOCOM or JSOC, you know, funds and logistical missions and all that, which is what all the other special operation commands plug into. And so there's a NATO force funds a lot of these, you know, commands. And so then you're playing with a very different pot of money, as well as resources, as well as the missions that you have access to. And at the time, the Marine Corps didn't have that, since the recon commands were only allowed to work for the Marine Corps. That changed when MARSOC stood up, and you know, that wasn't really on the radar at the time when I was in. And so I decided to actually leave the Marine Corps, transition into the Navy, because again, my brother was Army Special Forces. I wasn't going to be in the same, you know, unit or command or branch of service as my brother, because there was always kind of this very big rivalry between us, always trying to one up each other. And so I said, well, I'm going to go and, you know, transition into the Navy, go through the BUDS pipeline, and then hopefully one day make my way up to SEAL Team 6, which is known as DEV Group. That never happened. Basically, I had about 6 weeks of downtime between rolling over. And in this downtime, I was riding my motorcycle a lot, you know, recklessly. You know, not now that I've worked through a lot of emotional stuff, I can say that it was much in large part to my own carelessness, excessive speeding, a lot of it. Sure, there was another car that ran through a stop sign. But, you know, if I wasn't doing 65, 70 in a 35 mile an hour zone, I probably would have had no problem, you know, evading the vehicle. But since I was speeding, I ended up, you know, laying my bike down and having my accident, breaking my back.
Yeah. And because of that, then you, and I'm not quite clear on this, because I've seen some different images where I've seen you stand up. So describe exactly like what your condition is today.
Yeah. So my injury, I basically ended up landing on a pile of rocks on my back, and I ended up breaking my my back at the L1 vertebrae, but I didn't have a complete tear. So basically, I compromised somewhere in the realm of 60 to 70% of my spinal cord, thus having, you know, 40 to 30% of it still intact. And because of that, I actually had some return from below the level of injury, which is about the navel area. So below the my navel area, I have use of my quads, no glutes, and partial use of my hamstrings and adductors, but nothing below the knees. So I can wear these orthotic, they call them AFOs, which mimics a prosthetic. And when I have those on, because I can use my quads, I lock out my knees, and with a crutch, I actually can walk around pretty well.
Yeah, that's great. I've seen you drive. So, but like all these things, it's not just it's just like you pop these things on and you start walking. I mean, there's the realization that you used to be this badass, right? And you used to be able to do all this physical stuff. And I can't even imagine the nightmare. So how does somebody go from having a life altering injury like that to getting to the other side of, I don't know if depression is the wrong word, but, you know, I mean, it's not happy times, right? I mean, and you found a way out, but in a sense, you're back in where you started, right? You're not doing drugs, you're not in gangs, but you're back in that stuck spot. And like, how did you merge? Like, what was your goal that pulled you out of that?
There was no single one entity or pivotal moment that you know, I could chalk it all or sum it up. And it was basically the better part of a decade. The situation got to the point where, you know, I basically broke my back. And as far as I was concerned, it broke my spirit. Like, it broke me as a human being, because everything that I had accumulated to that point or amassed that would say I'm a dignified human being that is pulling his own weight and is worth, you know, validation and acknowledgement as a man, was all taken away from me in that accident. And since everything within me was attached to an identity, you know, outside of me, that accident cut that tie, right? And so I was left in limbo. And, you know, yeah, I actually started doing drugs again, meth, cocaine, hanging out with strippers. And, you know, very, very depressed, excessive drinking, an opioid addiction. I was actually I got to the point where suicidal ideation was normal. And when I was really inebriated, I actually made a couple attempts on my life unsuccessfully. And fortunately for me, my body can just take a shit ton of negligence and abuse. I say the two things that probably kept me clinging onto life and said, I have to sort this out and I have to figure this out was, one, our mother's sort of imprinted psychology. And it wasn't by any means like she was very insightful and philosophical. And she said, you know, this is what you, it was more so just how I experienced her, which is like, you know, to use Von Arbeles' words, like a rabid pit bull and fearless and never retreat, never surrender kind of mentality. And so the idea of quitting and taking my own life deliberately, you know, was always something I was pushed back against with this, well, that means you're quitting kind of thing. And the other element that really was the beacon of hope in an inspirational way. So my mother's, influence, I should say, sort of prevented access into quitting, right? But it wasn't inspiring me to find a new way. Well, that other inspiration basically came from my brother. Because once he, you know, spent some time in special forces with the Army, he actually made his way up to Delta Force. And when he made that jump, I said, man, that's my blood brother. Like, that's what we're capable of. If he can do something like that, I can surely do something, you know, half of that, you know, now that I'm half the man, right? So I was still kind of in this broken psychology that I'm broken. And I slowly started trying to kind of figure out ways to heal myself emotionally. On the outside, actually, you know, it, for all intents and purposes, most people would say, well, Oz is great, you know, because I was in Beijing and I won a gold and a bronze in 2008. But on the inside, you know, I was rotting from the inside out, you know, and I was barely hanging on to life. And I would say that those were all things that were just kind of distracting me from the pain that I was feeling on the inside. And I would say that I really didn't start to see the light at the end of the tunnel as far as, you know, my spiritual and emotional healing until about 2012. And the unintended consequence from winning a gold in 2008 was that I was sort of thrusted into this world of a mentor role model for the wounded warrior population that was coming back from the 9/11 campaign. Because there was a lot of injured vets coming back. And so they said, hey, you know, you're a veteran, you know, you've won a gold medal at the games, you know, maybe you can shed some light and you know, give an inspirational word to our men and women. And I was all about that, you know, because I never wanted out of the military. So I jumped on the opportunity. And all I did was I parceled out all the crap that I was dealing, you know, the darker side of what I was going through. And because I didn't want to, you know, actually paint a bad picture for the, you know, the soldiers I was speaking with. So I basically took all of the highlights and the high points of my life, what I was doing, how I was still succeeding, how I was thriving. And I said this story over and over and enough times that I started to drink my own Kool-Aid, right? Because at the end of the day, really, the only thing I ever had to get over was myself, my way of thinking. And so whether we speak and say something to ourselves or repeat something to ourselves, whether it's true or not is irrelevant. If we say it enough times, it starts to become our lived reality and experience. And so once I started speaking a more inspirational and positive version of my own life, I started to move towards that. And eventually this cathartic experience allowed me to let go of all of the baggage emotionally.
Yeah. So would you say that was the, you found your purpose that was given to you from helping lead others out of their dark spot of coming back from, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan?
Yes.
Like that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, you know, very much so.
Yeah, I don't want to trivialize this at all of what I'm going to say, because as you're telling me your story of how you went through this dark depression, and trust me, I'd be in the same spot. I couldn't help but thinking of the movie Forrest Gump and Lieutenant Dan. And Lieutenant Dan, if you remember him, he was just a chocolate man, right? And he is out there and he's destroying himself. He's trying to basically kill himself, drink himself to get, you know, being with the wrong people that he shouldn't be with, the wrong girls, all that stuff. And ultimately, he just like bottoms out where there's only one way, and that's up. And that up was that his friend Forrest Gump had given him a path out to come and be his lieutenant or something on his boat, the Jenny, to go out and fish, right? And right. For you, your Jenny was sort of hopping back on that bus and helping to mentor others, and then realizing another thing that I love what you said was you kind of as you're mentoring these others, you kind of used the same verbiage and the same words and what they needed to do so many times that those words of affirmation ultimately became your words of affirmation that you're believing, you know, your own Kool-Aid of what you're selling because it was true. And I mean, I've lived this myself so many times, which is words matter at the end of the day. They matter and they're strong and they're powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I experienced this phenomenon of this migration of, you know, once broken, joined the military, made something of seemingly something of himself, had this external validation, had the accident, broken yet again. This time I didn't see a way out of it. And then through, you know, again, this cathartic speaking experiences, like you said, sort of drinking my own Kool-Aid, became something myself. So I experienced this almost like this cycle, and I took note of it, and I said, "What's going on here?" And inevitably, what I learned was that it was like essentially nothing more. Well, I don't want to trivialize it, like you said, either, but an identity recreation, right? And so I found that the more one of the biggest things, I think Tom Sawyer's quote was, "It isn't what we don't know that gets us in the most trouble; it's what we know for certain that just ain't so." Right. And so I knew for certain that this is what success is. This is what a man is. This is what, you know, and so broken back, spinal cord injury and all of, you know, the variables around paralysis had nothing to do with my identity of a successful or dignified man. And so once I let go of these notions and replaced them with whatever, you know, I unintendedly created through that platform of speaking to the, you know, Wounded Warrior community, then I realized like I did this just nothing more with the speaking a new idea. And then I migrated my identity and what is this all about and how do I learn this and how could I really lean into this idea and then teach it. And so that's what landed me back in school. And then in graduate school, I went through a marriage and family therapy program because I wanted to learn theory and the psychological phenomenon to actually help somebody go from point A to point B. And speak to the ideas deliberately, right? So I didn't want to be just a motivational or inspirational speaker. I wanted to be somebody who, you know, who can actually give you a tangible skill that you can then take home and do some Googling and researching on, and then develop and then start to apply in your own life. And I did that while getting ready to compete in the 2018 World Championships, and I was thriving and during that entire time because I started to lean into these a lot of these ideas. So one of my favorite books around the themes is Stoicism. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Stoicism, but Marcus Aurelius is probably one of the most biggest names in the Stoic. Bill Belichick is another one who probably practices these concepts, but they really allow us to sort of take whatever life throws at us, right? So fate is not something that we can influence, but destiny is something that we can actually manipulate. And the difference is that, you know, fate is like if a hurricane comes in or a thunderstorm or a tidal wave, and you know, takes your home or whatever. There's nothing you can do around that. That is fate. But destiny is a different thing entirely. That we have the ability to create and manifest for ourselves. Should we learn these ideas around these phenomenons with philosophy and psychology, and that's kind of where I've been at for the last probably 4 years with regards to trying to build a sort of this space where I coach clients around these notions. So
I love that. My destiny, Mount Everest.
I saw that. So, yeah. 29,000 feet.
Yeah, 29, 32 feet and Lhotse, 27,940 feet. And, you know, that came out of adversity, right? And so pulling, having to pull something out. But, you know, I think we can all learn something from understanding that we all go through lows, understanding that there's a path out, and never understanding that the game is over, ever. I mean, that's what I've learned, right? I'm cruising around on the internet and all of a sudden I was on YouTube and I happened to land where Gene Simmons, the co-founder of Kiss, crazy man with makeup and big tongue hanging out, is there promoting you in some way. How would you ever get hooked up with the you know, one of the original members of Kiss?
Well, the short version of that was I ended up being one of the characters that was featured in a documentary called Unbeaten, which much of the footage was filmed by an individual named Stephen Barber. And Stephen Barber is quite a character, very much an acquired taste, love-hate kind of guy. But he's fearless and he's just aggressive and he doesn't back down or shy down from anybody. And somehow he got hooked up with Gene Simmons, and I don't know what he sold it, how he sold it, but he got him on board, and we actually drove up to his house in Los Angeles and filmed a small segment with his endorsement and support of that documentary.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. The movie Unbeaten, does that only feature you, or is there a multi-segment of inspirational folks like you have come back and done pretty amazing stuff?
Yeah, it's very much the latter. Yeah, there's three other athletes that are specifically wheelchair racers. So if you consider the different adaptive sports, our version of running would be this, what's generally called a marathon chair, but you're essentially pushing on the push rim. And so there's this event, or it was at the time, I'm not sure if that's actually still on, a race across Alaska from, I want to say, Fairbanks, Alaska to Anchorage, which is some 267 miles-ish that we race over the span of 5 days. So, you know, I don't remember what that math was, but I think it's some 40, 50 miles a day. So there's a hand bike division, which is the one I competed in for the 3 years I did that race. And then there's the wheelchair marathoner division. On a hand bike, you know, you got gears, you know, you can coast, it's a bike, you know, so, traversing 40 miles a day and with that elevation, I think we covered about 10,000 feet of elevation in that 267 miles is one thing. And that's respectable and that's quite an accomplishment. But these three other guys in that documentary did that on their marathon chairs, which has no gears. It's like basically a wheelchair with one wheel out front. And wow, those guys, I don't think two of them finished it, but in any case, the original piece was Stephen Barber filming those guys through Sadler's Alaska Challenge, which was actually funded by Paul Mitchell. And then at that event is where we linked up, and he ended up actually featuring myself and another teammate, Alejandro Abor, as we were making our attempt to make the team to Beijing, and then for glory in Beijing, of which I inevitably pulled off.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. So what is life like for you today? You touched on it for just a moment. You know, you went to school and to learn these different things, but, you know, especially navigating through COVID and all that kind of stuff, like where do you sit in terms of mentally, physically, emotionally, you know, like where does all that land?
I am in a very serene place. I've really picked up on the notions of Lao Tzu and Zen ideologies, and the whole notion of balance and centeredness. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, I'm currently in a space where I coach a handful of clients. I'm technically a life coach, is the umbrella term that they use for. You know, it's good. It's not therapy. It's not psychology, but it's a little bit of everything. So I have a handful of clients there. I would say the bulk of my day is going towards a sport and competition. I have been very fortunate enough to have still been able to remain competitive, and now have had a number of sponsors and endorsements that I can live full time as an athlete, which is extremely difficult to do in the Paralympic athletic field because. We could ask anybody, you know, pull any number of person aside in New York or Los Angeles or, you know, wherever large metropolitan area. Hey, do you know what the Paralympics are? And have you ever seen them on television? And most people will say, well, I have heard of them, but I've never seen anything like that. Right. And so the idea that anybody can make a career and have a respectable income to have a good life as a Paralympic athlete is pretty difficult to do. And I've been very fortunate to be able to do that. So essentially coaching, athlete, and then I have a 5-month-old son. That was a very unexpected twist in my path. And because honestly, me and my wife didn't plan to start attempting to have a child until after the Tokyo Games.
Yeah.
And that would have been a total blunder because nobody could have expected COVID and the postponement of the games. Mm. So we ended up accidentally getting pregnant in spite of her, you know, being on birth control and everything. And then the COVID hit and they postponed the games for a year. So actually everything worked out great.
So you're gearing up for the Tokyo Olympics.
Now I'm full swing for preparation for the games.
Yeah, no, man, you are a star. And go back to the first thing that we opened up. This is actually your tagline, not mine, but no limits. And, you know, when you kind of come from, you know, you start, I guess, on the other side of the street in the dark corner alley, and then you merge out of it and do some really amazing things. And you become a hero to me, many of our non-serving military folks, and come back and, you know, you think that, you know, you got life by the tail, and then, you know, this thing hits, and to pull yourself out, have that moment where you can really dig down and athletically pull yourself out. That's something you and I would very much align with. And you put a big ass goal to Olympics. I've only dreamed of being at Olympics. I don't think I have a shot anytime soon. So I'm climbing mountains instead. But at the end of the day, I always ask people, like, what's your Everest, right? It doesn't literally have to be Everest, but your Everest is something amazing. Your Everest is trying to win a gold at the Paralympic games in Tokyo. And you've won it before in other Olympic games like that. And it's amazing. And I'm sure you've got other goals that you want to have for yourself, just like I will when I come back. So where can people find you? You know, you're a really interesting dude. And I think you've got a lot to share.
Thanks. I am on Instagram at KNL Nation. So KNL stands for No Limits, which is my website name. Also on Facebook, I think Oz Sanchez. On Twitter, I think Oz Sanchez as well. But I'm mostly active on Instagram, which auto-populates to Facebook. So those are probably the two best platforms.
Yeah, love that, love that, love that. All right, man. Listen, I've really enjoyed getting to know you. Thank you, Vaughn, for the shout-out and the connection. And certainly if there's anything I can ever do for you, please let me know. Yeah, man, you're just a joy and a bright light, and you keep giving me reason. Got people like you on why I keep on with this podcasting, and it keeps me grounded, keeps me humble, and to understand other people's plights is really inspiring.
Yeah, and I echo that right back at you. I've read your page and your about page, and I think you have an upstanding mission that you have going on. I really support it, and I'm honored to be a part of your platform. So thanks for having me, Mark.
Yeah, right on. Okay, folks, there he is, the one, the only Oz Sanchez. Thank you very much.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.